This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we devote most of the broadcast to our coverage of the earthquake and devastation in Haiti. We'll hear from activists and journalists in Miami and Port-au-Prince. Plus, our special correspondent Kevin Pina and Pierre Labossière of the Haiti Action Network talk about the impact of current and historical U.S. policy in Haiti during this crisis. Also, nonviolent activist and organizer Jamal Jumaa talks about his month-long detention and psychological torture by Israeli security services in a Jerusalem interrogation center, and a special report with Palestinian academic and activist Haider Aid in Gaza City. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We have a major story breaking. Just a little bit of information. We grabbed this off the BBC. We're going to have a lot more for you, though. A powerful 7.3 magnitude, it's being called anywhere between 7 and 7.3 magnitude earthquake has struck off the coast of Haiti, rocking the capital and sparking a tsunami alert for neighboring states. Haiti's envoy to the U.S. said it was a catastrophe of major proportions. Joining us in studio to talk about the devastation and the implications is our own special correspondent for Haiti, Kevin Pina. What have we been able to learn? I know that we spent the last 2 hours trying to get through on the ground to Haiti, and we found out we couldn't even get through the U.S. Embassy. They're down.
Right. The landlines to the U.S. Embassy are down. Most cellular phone services down. We did try to, we did manage to get through to somebody, but we couldn't get anybody on the phone. Then we tried again and again and again. It's just impossible to get to the island. But what we do know is about 4.5 hours ago, this major quake struck the capital of Port-au-Prince. It was centered 10 miles west of the capital. Remember that there are more than 2 million people who are living on top of one another. There's very little infrastructure. We're seeing that the AP is quoting somebody from a Catholic Relief Service, from the Catholic Relief Services, who had spoken to colleagues before phone service was interrupted, who was quoted as saying there must be thousands of people dead right now in the capital of Port-au-Prince. This was followed by two major aftershocks, and we understand that the capital is still undergoing aftershocks, according to the U.S. Geological Survey.
I think they said 5.9, 5.6. Now, with an initial shock of over 7.0 in a place like Haiti, we have one hospital. We have reports, one hospital down, many people screaming from inside, people trapped. And, you know, help is on the way, but from where?
Right. There is no infrastructure. As I've reported, you know, I just got back last week on January the 5th from Haiti. Things were very, very drastic and dire then. I can't imagine how they're going to be able to deal with this catastrophe quickly enough. There has to be utter devastation in the capital, given these reports.
Well, we're trying to get through to some people in Florida, major Haiti community, Haitian community in exile and living in Florida. And I understand we're joined now by Farah Juste. She's a Haitian activist, a singer, a poet. And Farah Juste, welcome back to Flashpoints. I understand you were speaking to your mom in a wheelchair in Port-au-Prince, and then you were disconnected. What can you tell us about what's going on?
The situation is getting worse and worse in Haiti. I've got somebody calling me from Jacmel, and they told me that some very drastic movement are being done when it's come to the sea, and they don't like it. They're afraid that there'll be a tsunami or whatever. And in Port-au-Prince is totally in darkness. All the telephone poles are down, and the electricity poles are down. It was said that the cathedral has been damaged very, very badly. The White Palace and the Palais Justice and many, many houses. I was speaking to my mother 2.5 hours ago, and my mother is in a wheeling chair, and she's very disabled, and somehow we got disconnected. And ever since, I'm trying to get in contact with her. And there is no way I can get through. I am not the only one who's in that kind of situation, because we are communicating to each other here in Miami. All the Haitian radios are speaking about the situation. They're trying to get through themselves. The local Haitian television, Allen TV, is showing some image right now. We're in front of CNN. We're all communicating to each other because, as you know, we are 1 hour from Haiti. The 1 hour 45 minutes is just for the takeoff and the landing. We really, there was a bridge. We would be about I'd say 50 minutes from Haiti. So we are very close and we are communicating to each other, and we're very worried. We're hearing things from time to time. The foundation of the houses in Haiti were not adequate for this type of situation. Half of it, and this is a catastrophe. And I was told that the whole country, Port-au-Prince especially, is. You have to understand that Port-au-Prince was built for 275,000 people. Right now, there's 2 million and something in Port-au-Prince. So you can imagine. Even last year, there was a few schools that was close to the mountain that fell. And right now, Canapé Vert, which is one of the biggest hospital between Canapé Vert and Pétionville, has been collapsed. And plenty of patients were there. Right now is in the darkness. The doctors cannot even help the patient because they cannot see. Oof. This is a total disaster. My country has been very unfortunate situation for my country. We're dealing with so much poverty. We're dealing with so much bad political situation where the government now is not helping really. And the UN was there. President Clinton has been going there saying that he was going to do something. But, of course, we cannot expect him to have miracle. But we're in a very, very, very difficult situation right now. And, man, Kevin, it's bad. It's bad.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue to follow the unfolding tragedy in Haiti, one of the poorest countries in the world now, devastated by an earthquake in excess of 7.0 on the Richter scale yesterday, many aftershocks. We're going to go right to Miami, where we're joined by Ronald Louis. He's the former Director General of Television National for Haiti. He's the Director of Radio Caju in Miami, and he's been on the phone all day. He's been following the situation in his home country. Good to have you with us, sir.
How you doing?
Doing well. I'm here with Kevin Pina. I know that you have been trying to get as much information as you can from the ground. How can you give us sort of an overview? What do we know about the extent of the damage so far?
Well, so far, aside of what the Prime Minister had said, close to 100,000 people may have lost their lives. What I'm trying to focus on is how many of the officials, or how many elected officials, how many people from the member of Préval's cabinet have been accounted for. And there are rumors, and I just don't want to go on rumors because so far many of them have been unfounded. However, one thing I'd like to share with you guys that I see a lot of folks are not focusing on is the political aspect of what's going on in Haiti right now. Bear in mind that the Monroe Doctrine is still well and alive. And I think that France's reaction to sending an emergency crew way before the U.S. was able to do anything kind of triggered the current presidency, U.S. presidency, to extend the coverage of the help that they wanted to give to Haiti. Because yesterday at some point someone mentioned that Obama wanted to take control of the overall rescue operation down in Haiti, meaning that everybody down there will have to follow U.S. rules rather than doing their own thing. My take on that is that if you look back at each time there's a disaster or some political or economic turmoil in Haiti, there is always some major change in the political structure, in the constitution, and or in the economic situation in Haiti. People have to remember back in 1915, when U.S. landed in Haiti from 1915 to 1934, the gold was a strong currency. It was at that point was one gold for $1. 3 years later, it became five goods for a dollar. A lot of folks didn't know about this, thinking that it was always like that until we later on have it.
Well, there is great concern now, given that history and the way in which the country was allowed to sort of deteriorate without any support and World Bank policies. I'm wondering what you have actually heard from, in terms of your reports from the ground. What are some of the stories and the struggle that people are facing right now?
Well, basically, people need help. Everyone is basically homeless right now in Haiti. But at the same time, while we're looking for that kind of support that Haiti needs, it's important that we don't lose track of the overall picture, because once decisions are made as to what's going to happen in the political structure, that's it. It's done. Once a decision is made to publish a new constitution and remove things that had protected people all along, it's done. And no one is talking about it. It's true. We need help. Right now, people need water and basic. I would not even talk about bringing milk or chocolate. Things would get them sick. I would have bars like
energy bars and stuff.
Energy bars, that kind of thing. At least to help them get back into regular nutritional situation. Because right now, people are hungry. They have been. A lot of folks haven't been able to have anything to eat for over 24 hours. Some of them were already on a special diet. Now this is the kind of thing that's needed. I'm in contact with an organization that has agreed to focus on getting water and fruit bars and nutrition bars and what have you. And that is that's going to take place tomorrow. I mean, from what I understand, they have two cargo planes that somehow have been, in a sense, allowed to for free to help that situation. And that's basically that's the first step.
That's what we're hearing, is two planes, which isn't a lot.
And that is the voice of Renaud Louis, who is the former director of Haitian National Television. This is Kevin Pina on Flashpoints on KPFA Pacifica out of Berkeley, California. Renaud, I'm really wondering, with all this devastation, as you said, we heard Prime Minister Jean-Max Bellerive today say that as many people as 100,000 may have actually died from the earthquake and the aftershocks. We know that it's total devastation in the capital. Certainly Obama made a strong statement today of support. But what I'm wondering, you had mentioned the political context.
Yes.
Don't you think that given that Haitians really need to pull together in unity, this would be a perfect time for President Aristide to be allowed to return from exile in South Africa to help unify the Haitian people as they rebuild?
Probably, especially when the majority party, which is Lavalle's party, is fragmented. That's probably, certainly. But what I also what I don't want you to lose track of that the fact that what's his name, Sarkozy, about 6 months ago, said that he wanted to take over Lagonave, a concession for 20 years. And we have to understand what it means, what they have found and what they have discovered there. And that's how he gets into kind of conflict with U.S. policies. So the question is whether or not who's going to decide and what it is that the Haitian people will have to say in what's going to happen during that process. And that's why I'm saying that while we're looking at bringing the help, at the same time, we're looking at whatever permanent structure is going to exist. Now, the question is, people have asked that before, is it the right time for Aristide to come back? The final decision will have to be between the U.S. and Prival, because if you remember, last intervention of President Aristide was that his passport expired. In order for him to have a laissez-passer from the Haitian government, it has to be signed by Préval. The question is that, is he willing to do that, or will he be allowed to do it? And that's a big question.
Well, and the real question is whether he should do it, and I think that a lot of Haitians would agree that he should. And I think it's interesting to note that the first person that President René Préval called to let the world know that he was safe was the French ambassador at the French embassy in Port-au-Prince. Renaud, I want to thank you for being on our show today. We've got a few more guests. That was Renaud Louis, the former director of Haitian National Television, coming to us from Miami. He's also the director of Radio Cajou in Miami, Florida. I now want to bring on a good friend of mine in Miami. It's André Joseph, also known as Yeye Bull. He's got a very popular program called Variété et Vibration in Miami. Yeye, are you there?
How are you, buddy?
I'm doing okay. Listen, though, what are you hearing about what's going on the ground right now? It's very sketchy. Myself, I've been trying all night, literally 5 hours, 20 numbers, could not get through to a single line. Are you able to get through it all? Are you getting any news out?
Kevin, CNN is our only source of information. Only CNN gives us information. We have no way of talking to Haiti. All the phone lines are dead. As you know, I have a story in Miami that sells minutes on the internet to people. Yesterday, there was about a couple of dozen people in line trying to buy minutes to call home. None of them were able to get in. Also, even right now, in the store, there is a line of people buying minutes to call Haiti. They're not able to get in because the lines are down. Whatever means of communication they have with their cell phone or landline is down. So CNN is our only source of information. I have a guy who gave me news from Haiti on my show. I can't find him. None of them were unaccounted for. I have no idea what's happening with their family members. I have no communicating with them.
Do you find this suggestion of 100,000 people to be believable, credible? Could that many of people, that many people, have died?
Kevin, it is possible. It's more than that. Right now, you know, people construct the way they want to construct. There's no state governed way to check and see how the constructions are done. As you know, last year there was a school that collapsed with 100 people were dead. Right now, the Haitians couldn't handle one building being collapsed. Right now, you got hundreds of buildings collapsed, hotels collapsed, hospital collapsed, national palace collapsing. Also, you have aftershock. So it's something beyond our means. We're asking for the world to help, and they help us to come right now.
And what is it like? What is the mood? What is the feeling like on your radio show? Are people really troubled? Are they desperate? Are they sort of telling stories about the last time? I know a lot of people we spoke to were talking to their loved ones, talking to family, and then they would just cut off.
They were cut off. Some of them weren't even able to connect. What's happening right now, what's really bothering these people is the silence they're getting. They have nobody to talk to. They call me on the air. Have you heard something from my area? Anything from my town? I say, I don't hear nothing without no communication means. And they still keep calling and calling. They're desperate. They are crying on the air. People walking in the street like dead zombies don't even know which way to go because they have no idea of how to contact their loved ones. All I can tell them is just keep calling until you're with somebody. But right now, they have no way of talking to anybody. It's not, if you connect for 5 seconds, you say it's cut off in a minute.
All right. I want to thank you very much for being with us on Flashpoints. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I'm here with Flashpoints special correspondent for Haiti, Kevin Pina.
You know, I can really share Yeye's frustration and the frustration of so many thousands, I'm sure, of Haitians in Canada and the United States. I know that my wife is worried sick. We're not able to know where her father is, her mother. We don't know where Jean is, where Lona is. We don't know where her brothers and sisters are. Sanson. Jean-Jean, her sister Natalie, we don't know where they are, and probably the worst part of this is not being able to know whether something has happened to them or not. It's absolutely nerve-wracking, and my prayers and my feelings go out for all of the thousands and thousands of Haitians and I'm sure other Americans who have loved ones in Haiti who are suffering the same thing.
Well, we have some good news, which is that we managed to pin down the fact that Walter Riley, an attorney, an activist, very involved in Haiti, was in Haiti with his wife Barbara, also an attorney, I believe.
Barbara Ryan.
And we just managed through Boots Riley, Boots is a son of Walter Riley, to confirm that they are alive and they have now joined working on the relief effort. So those of you who are friends, who have worked with Walter Riley and worked with Barbara, let you know that they are okay, and we're still trying to reach them. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We have made contact on the ground in Haiti with Ansel Hirz. He's a journalist there in the middle of the earthquake. Thanks for joining us at this last minute. Let's get right to it. Maybe you can give us an overview of what you've been seeing today, what you've been hearing, what your senses are telling you, what's going on.
I think that it's just continuing to be a disaster scene. There are a lot of people outside, basically in with makeshift tents that I saw, makeshift kind of lean-tos to try to prop up some kind of shelter for them. People are still remaining in the streets quite a bit, even if they do have houses, because they're afraid that those buildings are going to continue to crumble and fall. I wasn't able to really get downtown too much today, but I was downtown all day yesterday, and I saw no aid of any kind, official aid or any official rescue efforts ongoing for ordinary Haitians in the buildings around. It was basically everybody was out on their own, and Haitians were coming together in different bands, you know, a dozen people here, a dozen people there, to try to pull people out of the rubble, whether that was in downtown central Port-au-Prince or in Cité Soleil, which actually I made a point of going to Cité Soleil, and the damage there, I would say, is not as bad as I expected it to be, given that there's so many fragile shacks there. Really, many of them are standing, the majority, and the damage was not quite as bad as I expected. That said, there are a lot of shacks that you know, just crumbled entirely, and of course the people who are extremely poor already, it's really hard to imagine how they're going to survive at this point in terms of just getting food and water, and I'll leave it there for now. Sure.
Talk a little bit more about what you saw as you moved through the streets yesterday in terms of the damage. We're hearing any figures anywhere from 10,000 to 100,000. From your experience, tell us a little bit more about what you saw and your assessment.
Yeah, just a lot of people in the street, families out in the street. I talked to a lot of people, and you know, they're differing kind of opinions and assessments about what's happened. But you know, just to take one example, there was a woman looking for her son. Her son was a prisoner at the National Penitentiary, and the National Penitentiary in downtown Port-au-Prince, essentially the roof is missing. I went down there, and the roof is just gone, and it basically crumbled. And there was a fire inside the penitentiary, and the prison is entirely empty. So people are just walking in and out of it. Presumably, basically all the prisoners escaped, or maybe some of them were shot by police. There was a rumor, and that's unconfirmed, that the police were shooting prisoners. So this woman was just looking for her son. She has really no way to find him, just other than to try to follow some kind of path from the penitentiary. She's just not sure what she can do. Her house in Tabar collapsed entirely. She was saying, you know, where are the Americans? Where are the peacekeepers? I just see them driving around. I don't see any rescue of any kind. She said Haiti is finished. She was very hopeless. I've talked to other people who are sort of just have a very, very cautious optimism that some kind of help was going to come, and they're going to be able to find a way to survive.
And in terms of the aid, it is really now beginning to be curious that it's taking so long. We understand some Chinese aid workers arrived there before the United States got there, and the sense is that the U.S. is first interested in securing the island, making it militarily safe, and then they're going to be dealing with potential unrest, and then they're going to get to the aid. What's your assessment of, should there be a little more aid there? Is the airport open?
The airport is, you know, I don't know exactly. I was at the airport today, and I saw no flights going in and out, but there are a lot of people just crowded around the terminal trying to get in and out. A lot of journalists were arriving, so I presume there are flights coming in. You know, I saw NBC and CNN and all these crews coming down, and to me it's just kind of perverse the way that they're all coming down to basically do the exact same story now, when, you know, at a time when they could be doing real investigative journalism here in Haiti to improve the situation in a long term, they're absent. They're never here. So as far as the airport, you know, I don't know really what the specific status is in terms of flights going out. And in terms of aid coming in, again, I saw no official aid convoys downtown at all. I saw none of that. People were on their own and just helping each other. I don't know to what extent that's changed since yesterday, whether there's aid coming in now, more in a widespread way.
Following up on the penitentiary, we know there were some 4,000 people in there. Only about 600 were convicted of anything. There were many political prisoners. Do we know where all those 4,000 people are?
No, not at all. I have no idea, you know, where they went. I'm presuming that they tried to find loved ones and are out there surviving. You know, I really doubt that the police were able to capture any of them shoot many of them, because it seemed like the building just kind of collapsed and opened up, and so I don't know what their situation is. I haven't, you know, found any prisoners roaming the streets or anything. I want to mention that, you know, I was on CNN yesterday. Actually, Wolf Blitzer interviewed me on Skype, and I came on after a CNN correspondent who had just arrived, and he was talking with the head of Haitian police in the country, and this policeman was sort of talking about the possibility that there were bandits, and that, you know, the prison falling is a huge catastrophe, and so there's fears of you know, dangerous crime taking place, and the reporter seemed to sort of just swallow that and sort of hype these fears of violence. I've seen no violence at all, and people I've talked to, aid workers and other Haitians, have seen no violence of any kind in the streets. That's not to say it's not happening, but it doesn't seem to be widespread.
Do you see the UN taking any action? Do you see the UN taking any action?
Still with their own personnel to a large extent. You know, their headquarters collapsed in Bourdon, and I'm actually in the Brazilian base right now, borrowing a computer. They're doing fine here, but their base in Cité Soleil collapsed as well, and I have some footage of that of just these guys trying to dig through that base to try to rescue Brazilian soldiers, some of whom did die there. So I you know, I haven't seen MINUSTAH really initiating rescue efforts per se. You know, you see them driving around like always, but again, I haven't seen many official rescue efforts at all from you know, large scale equipment or anything like that.
Is it your concern that people who are in trouble now, who may have been wounded, will be dying if the aid doesn't get there soon? Is this a real possibility that a lot of lives could be lost because of the timing?
Absolutely, I think so. I mean, you know, again, I don't want to make it sound worse than it is or something, but I don't see how these people are going to get food and water. You know, there are markets that are operating. There's food and water on the streets that you can get if you have money and if you have the resources to get to those markets, if you have a car or something, and if you have a place that you can come back and cook the food. If you don't have those things, if your house is collapsed or if you're destitute like so many people are here in Port-au-Prince, I don't know what you can do to survive. I think a lot of people are going to be really sick and maybe dying here as well.
And what about medical care? Is that a grave concern of yours right now in terms of the infrastructure collapsing and the fact that there was a very limited system of medical care before the quake hit?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody knows that the hospitals here in Port-au-Prince are basically always overcrowded and unreliable. And so I'm sure, you know, their capacity is just absolutely overloaded. I'm sure there are many people going without the care that they need. I heard somebody on Democracy Now! Talking about a makeshift clinic that they set up and people dying before their eyes. So, you know, that's certainly happening. And I haven't seen, you know, Doctors Without Borders or something like that out there saving lives. Maybe it's happening, but I don't see people getting the medical care that they need. I met a sick woman just outside the base earlier today. And she was just asking for some money. She really didn't have any options.
We're hearing a lot of stories about many dead.
If I could just add something, I wanted to add that I did see a lot of people today with masks on, you know, the kind of mask that you wear when you're like vacuuming your house or something, because I think there is an awareness that airborne diseases are potentially going to be traveling. So, you know, again, I think you got to give Haitians a lot of credit for just being smart about staying away from buildings that can collapse, and also, you know, being aware that these diseases can travel. I saw a lot of people with those masks, and I still don't have one. I need to get one. So.
And there's a concern that we're hearing reports and seeing some photographs about many bodies piled up outside the morgue, bodies being unattended to. I imagine that could present a major medical difficulty. Is this something that you witnessed and that other people are witnessing?
I didn't witness it myself, but I talked to a German aid worker who said that the morgue is totally overloaded, that their electricity is not good or totally out, and so they're not able to process the bodies that are coming in. So I think the morgue is, I imagine, just a hellish situation right now.
And in terms of the people that you work with, the other reporters, the aid workers, is everybody safe? No. Are all the people that you work with accounted for? How are people dealing with that?
One friend of mine, a Haitian journalist, his house, he said, is broken. That's really all I heard from him. We haven't been able to get back in touch since then. I'm trying to find him and link up with him. Everybody else, thankfully, that in my personal social circle seems to be okay. Our house shook quite a bit. It was one of the few multi-story houses in a relatively poor neighborhood that did not collapse at the time. It just shook quite a bit, and we all got out of there really quick. So thankfully, me personally and my friends are doing okay. But it's just, you know, we're all really devastated by the situation. This just came out of nowhere.
And one final question. We understand there's massive damage in Port-au-Prince. What information do you have for us in terms of damage in other parts of the country, other cities? Are other cities affected?
I've really tried to find out what I can, and it's been difficult. I've heard that Cap-Haïtien, which is Haiti's second largest city, basically on the other side of the country in the northern part, is, you know, totally fine. I heard that Lacay got hit pretty hard to the south of Port-au-Prince. Certainly Carrefour, the suburb sort of of Port-au-Prince, a little bit west and south of here, I think got hit hard. I talked to one man who said he was out in the countryside yesterday. I think he said that he was in, I think it was Tigoa, but I might have that wrong. He said that things weren't too bad out there, that he didn't, you know, see too much damage, and that things were a lot worse here in Port-au-Prince. I think that, you know, the real disaster zone is here in Haiti's largest city. And I think other places were affected, but it's probably not as bad out there.
And just, I'm sorry, just one more follow-up. In terms of the children, we're hearing reports about children who've been separated, who've lost their parents. We've even heard stories of children still sleeping with the bodies of their parents. Do you have any information on this?
I can just say that a lot of schools collapsed, you know, schools that are two or three stories. There was a school in Cité Soleil that I saw. It's just, absolutely heartbreaking. The second floor of this school was just on the ground, literally on the ground. The first floor just, you know, got crushed into tiny bits. And, you know, I don't know, there were people crying outside. I don't know how many kids were inside at the time, because we had to move on. But so schools have collapsed, and I did meet some kids who were separated from their parents today, you know, right outside this base, actually. And so it's just, you know.
And
just
what were they saying? Situation. What were they saying? Were they asking for help?
He just, you know, he wanted some help. He wanted, you know, some money to buy some food. He didn't really have much to say other than that his parents are gone, and he didn't know if I think that he said he didn't know if they were dead or not. The other boy I talked to, I think he was probably about 12, said that his mom had died when the house collapsed while she was sleeping. So, you know, they're just, I think, sort of in a state of shock, but they're resilient. You know, it's not like they're just sitting on the side of the road waiting to die or something like that. I think it's important to not think of people as being passive victims. You know, people are doing their best, what they can, to survive and to work together again. I saw many cases of people trying to do what they can with their bare hands or with tools that they picked up to rescue people. So that's ongoing. And we are going to have to leave it there. So,
all right. I want to thank you very much. Ansel Hurz, is there a way people can follow your work?
Yes. My website is mediahacker.org. It's all one word, mediahacker.org. I'm actually having trouble updating that site itself. But if you go to it, there's a link to my Twitter page, which is I'm trying to update when I can.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for talking with us, Ansel Hurz, on the ground in Haiti. Be careful, please.
Okay.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. In the studio with me is Pierre Labossiere of the Haiti Action Committee, and our special correspondent for Haiti, Kevin Pina, is also in the studio. Pierre, first of all, respond to what you heard and what you've been able to learn today. I know it's an incredibly sad moment for you.
Yeah, it's pretty heart-wrenching. And the lies that are out there, you know, how, and Katrina keeps coming to my mind, you know, Katrina, the situation, the people of New Orleans.
Yeah, they just put George Bush, Obama just tasked George W. Bush with Bill Clinton to head up the relief. I guess his practice in Katrina is going to take, you know, be used here in Haiti.
Not to mention overthrowing Aristide's government in 2004.
Yeah, so basically I've been able to make contact with Haiti, and that's why, you know, the people are doing, and someone I was talking to was telling me how it's the people who are really out there trying to dig up, trying to help their brothers and sisters who are buried in those rubbles. And they're organizing as best they can with their bare hands and trying to make things happen. And no wonder, as I was listening to Ansel Hurz talking, no wonder that people in Haiti refer to Minusta as being turista, because that's a play on words, meaning there are a bunch of tourists there and, you know, living off the pain and the misery of the people of Haiti. So, And what Haitians are doing, basically, you have people, for example, I know in Miami, there is a group that I don't know if they made it out yet, but they had a plane load of supplies and materials to go to Haiti. And I know locally in the Bay Area, there are some Haitian nurses who are getting ready to go and go lend a hand. And other places are organizing as well. And again, I want to commend the Cubans and the Venezuelans for being so quick to respond. And it's no big fanfare. They are just there. There is the emergency and they are there. And I heard that there is this ship from China that has already gotten there. And when I compare that, the U.S. is so close. I mean, it's an hour and a half flight from Miami. But again, going back to Katrina was, I mean, New Orleans was right here.
Yeah, well, Venezuela got there faster, too, than the United States.
So it's very sad. But I have to say that... What As I'm this morning, I was looking at the footage, and I thought, oh my God, this is immediate response, beautiful, stuff is landing, people are probably, and now I'm hearing this report. So that means we have to be careful how people manipulate images and footage and camera, because they bring that to us on our in our living rooms, in our bedrooms, and we think, oh man, I can just relax, things are being done. But you know, no, that's not the case. So I want to say this to urge people to continue with your efforts. The people of Haiti have always counted on the solidarity of brothers and sisters right here in the U.S. Throughout the world, people-to-people connection. That is what has always worked. And we can trust these big government. I hate to use that term, but because the evidence speaks for itself right here as I'm listening to this live report on the ground.
Kevin, just the news of your own life, a reporter who we have depended on to get information for this show, Jean Restil, was wounded, and his children, I understand, two children were killed?
That's right.
And this is somebody you work closely with?
Right. He had worked with me as a cameraman on my last film.
And did you speak with him today?
Just briefly, but I mean, I just got to say that, you know, this is day three of this crisis, and the actions of the Obama administration are costing thousands of lives in Haiti. These precious hours, few hours after this, when people are buried under rubble, to then allow, it's inconscionable that civilian relief that's already been mobilized is not being allowed into Haiti while the Obama administration waits for the Pentagon to take military control of the country.
They're talking next Friday for all the troops to arrive.
It's unconscionable. People are dying.
Tomorrow.
People are dying as a direct result of this decision by the Obama administration. And you got to wonder, is it on purpose?
Yeah, and there's a good reason why the Obama administration has given this over to the National Security Agency and turned it into a military action. And in a few words, what is it?
Well, I mean, it's quite clear that President Preval was building what he called a unity government that contained largely members of the opposition that helped to oust Aristide. They are now in shambles. Today it was announced that one of the main leaders of that opposition, Michel Gaillard, his body was found in the Ministry of Justice. Paul Denny, who's the Minister of Justice, was in the same meeting with him. Although his body was not found, he is presumed dead. Another major leader of that opposition. Kelly Bastien, the President of the Senate, his body's not been recovered yet, but he's missing, presumed dead when the Parliament collapsed. Half of the Parliament is missing, and more than half of the Cabinet is missing inside of Haiti. In the meantime, another supporter of the opposition against Aristide, the Archbishop of Port-au-Prince, Serge Mio, is dead. This has altered everything on the ground. This is, and I think that they fear very much what the ramifications of this is going to be.
And so you've got a military operation by the United States government, which removed Aristide. We've got Clinton and Bush. Bush removed Aristide as president. Clinton has been repressing the country ever since he became the special envoy, the mm-hmm. UN special envoy. And the United States now, and all the puff pieces, Pierre, Kevin, were about how everything was on track in Haiti before the hurricane hit. How President
before
Preval...
The earthquake hit.
How President Preval had... created this unity, how people were working together, the elections were coming up. This is all a big lie.
Absolutely. I mean, I spent a month there. You know, I got back just last week before this earthquake hit, and those were exactly the voices that we were hearing in the poor neighborhoods throughout Port-au-Prince, was that they had lost faith in the Preval government. They no longer felt that it was representing them. Most importantly, they felt that the billions of dollars of aid that was coming in was being used by the Preval administration, first of all, to prop up his own government and his own system of political patronage, but more importantly, to try to destroy the popular movement of the poor, of the Lavalas movement that supported Aristide and continues to support Aristide.
And again, to be clear, the airport, the Associated Press, which is straight up State Department around Haiti now, the New York Times, the major media are reporting that the airport is too damaged to accept all these flights coming in with aid. No, that's not the story. The story is that the United States government decided that only the military will land. So they let some journalists in, they closed down the airport, and they're going to use it for a military operation.
You know, I think I recorded that CNN story when CNN first arrived on the ground when they said the tarmac in Port-au-Prince was undamaged. There was slight damage to the building. And they interviewed Rene Préval in front of the airport 2 days ago saying that he was going to sleep inside of the facility because he did his, both his home and the presidential palace collapsed.
And several reporters came in on that airport this morning and said it was fine. So a number of planes were landing. I want to come back to you. We're running out of time here, Pierre, because we've got an interview coming up, Nora did, with somebody who just got out of a torture prison in the West Bank, and we need to get to that story. But in terms of, again, how can people who are listening to this broadcast support the people of Haiti? How can they work with you and the various projects? What are you recommending, Pierre?
Definitely to get on our website, HaitiAction.net.
HaitiAction.net.
And HaitiSolidarity.net, and to support us and be in touch with the people of Haiti. Don't fall for the hype. Work directly with the grassroots organizations in Haiti and put pressure. Expose, listen to flashpoints, expose what's going on in Haiti so that we are not duped, we are not fooled by it, and put pressure on the administration.
Pierre, you know, some people are saying, I even heard in alternative news, this network, that now's not the time to get into the politics. Now's not the time to talk about bringing Aristide. But Kevin feels very strongly, and I imagine you do, that part of the healing process here that could make things work better would be to bring him back. Well, what do you think about that?
Oh, most definitely. To bring back President Aristide, because he's the voice of the people. Number one, it's illegal what has happened. And my answer to it's not the time for politics. All I can say is remember New Orleans. Remember the Katrina, our brothers and sisters who suffered so much, and the lies that were put out there. And to this day, the suffering of the people of New Orleans and of the survivors.
Final words, Kevin.
Well, you know, I mean, it's clear that Aristide would mobilize people. He would mobilize the grassroots movement. People still have tremendous respect and love for him. That's the last thing that the Obama administration wants. Anyway, you know, I got to just say also my prayers and my thoughts to the thousands of Haitians throughout the United States, Canada, and the world who are worried about their loved ones. We're in a similar position, my family. We still have not had word of my wife's mother, father, her three sisters, and her two sisters and her two brothers.
They don't know if they're dead or alive.
We have no idea at this point, and we're just praying for the best as so many, many others are throughout the world.
And I imagine the same thing with you, Pierre. Friends, colleagues, relatives.
Friends and colleagues. I got word about my relatives. They're okay.
They're okay.
And
we know, Mathieu got a little damage. More information. Walter Riley is okay.
Yes.
We've essentially confirmed that, although we haven't spoken with him.
That's right.
Randall's okay. Ray Adoles, Hopi Dep School's okay.
Okay.
Now we got good word that Jean Rastil's okay. He's injured, but he did lose two of his children.
Lost his children. All right, we're going to leave it right there. We're going to have to turn it to Palestine, another disaster area in this world. But we're going to stay on this show, Pierre. Our heart goes out to all of you and to the Haitian people. Thanks for the support. Thanks for coming in on this difficult day.
Thank you so much, Dennis.
Thank you, Dennis.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Stay tuned.
When soldiers patrol, or should say occupy, responsibility to protect such a lie. Like a late night rerun, old drama repeated, same story played again, while the act conceded. The poor majority, innocent or guilty, true solidarity against a war treaty. Was the same foreign troops out here to kill bandits, stolen page from the past, used tricks underhanded. It's the same difference, history repeats itself, but masses will not bow down to those with wall. That's why my expression against the oppression should serve as a lesson for all those who still
in Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. 2 days ago, Flashpoints correspondent Jamal Juma'a, coordinator of the Stop the Wall campaign in the West Bank, was released from a month in detention in Jerusalem. Also released was Mohammed Athman, also a Stop the Wall organizer, who was arrested by Israeli forces in September. In mid-December, Jumaa was arrested at his home and taken to Muscovia Detention and Interrogation Center. Flashpoint spoke with Jamal Jumaa earlier today. Jamal Jumaa, thank you so much for being with us today. It's really a relief to know that you're out of Israeli jail and back to work in the struggle for justice in occupied Palestine. Briefly, tell us what happened to you last month when you were arrested and what happened during the month you were in the Muscovia Detention Center in Jerusalem, which is notorious for psychological and physical torture of Palestinians.
Yeah. You know, just like a month ago, I was surprised that they raided my house almost at midnight, and they arrested me and took me to the Muscovia, which is one of the. It's not a jail even; it's like a place where they interrogate the people. One of the worst deputated places that they interrogate the people in. And I spent them there in the cells, in the solitary confinement also. Something like first 15 days, then after that in the other cells where they start to bring people with me. You know, it's like, it's really what's going there. Nobody has been talked about or wrote about it even. It is one of the worst things that you can imagine. The violation of the people's right there is unbelievable. It is, the conditions in these cells is like totally unhuman and dehumanizing the people. It is all psychological pressure made just like to destroy destroy the prisoners, to destroy them totally. And I witnessed there some of the cases, especially young people who have nervous people from the situation there. The food is like the worst that you can imagine. It's very dirty. It's like you are sleeping in the cell where just like as 2 meters wide and length where you head and near the door, and there you live in the bathroom. And sometimes there's two in the cell, which is like became really unbelievable. Blanket is like horse blankets, which is like very dirty. The mat is like just 5 centimeters wide. You don't see anything. It's just like there's two lights and small lights in the cell, 24 hours. Nobody tell you what the time is, so you think you are isolated totally from the whole world, from the life you are isolated. And they put you in this condition is like, would you think that hey, this is the end, this is the end, this is the end of your life. You are not even anymore in the life there. It's a hour of interrogation, where you cuffed and on a chair, plastic for 14 hours, 13 hours, sometimes 20 hours, and I met prisoners there, they spent 7 days continuously and 5 days continuously without even letting them sleep. And they are cuffed on their back and or on the chair, not letting them move. So this is like a little bit part of the what you can witness and you see there. Besides the ventilations that they have and the air conditioning inside this dirty cells, which is sometimes hot, sometimes cold, and the water that you drink from this tap, which is oxided and very dirty, you just start. The third day, your stomach became blocked and your whole system, whole body became, you feel it don't function well at all, This is what Palestinian prisoners has been facing since long time. As I told you, nobody's talking about it. Even my lawyer, he surprised me when he asked me for the first time in the time visiting me after 12 days. He asked me, describe me the cell, what it looks like. Even the lawyers, human rights organizations, the Red Cross, nobody allowed to go there and to check what's going on. So it's really horrible. It's really horrible what's going on there. The prisoner really passing into very terrible situation there.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. It has been another bloody time for Palestinians trapped inside the occupied Gaza Strip. Just in the past 2 weeks, Israeli forces have killed 10 people in multiple airstrikes and artillery fire across Gaza, including a series of attacks last Thursday night that killed 3 Palestinians and tank shellings that killed 2 in the northern part of the Strip. Meanwhile, in the occupied West Bank, Israeli bulldozers were hard at work over the weekend, demolishing hundreds of acres of agricultural land and homes that house a reported 150 Palestinians in the northern Nablus area. Today, Israeli forces reportedly prohibited Palestinian farmers from planting 1,500 olive trees in the Abu Arish area of the Beit Omar village near Hebron. This comes on the heels of accelerated Israeli soldier and settler invasions and attacks, including raids by the military into the villages of Bilayin and Na'alin, two strongholds of anti-apartheid wall protests in which the military kidnapped and arrested several members of the nonviolent popular committees in each village. And in the West Bank village of Umatin, Israeli settler groups wearing black ski masks assaulted a number of Palestinian farmers as the Israeli military, quote, joined forces with the settlers and prevented the farmers from working on their land, according to news reports. And Al Jazeera is reporting that Israel has approved plans to build a wall along part of its southern border with Egypt, a project that will cost at least $270 million. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, said in a statement on Sunday that the wall is a, quote, strategic decision to ensure the Jewish and democratic character of the state of Israel. However, Palestinians believe the new barrier is another example of an Israeli land grab. Finally, in a report by the U.S. Weekly Defense News, the U.S. Army will double the value of, quote, emergency military equipment it stockpiles on Israeli soil, and Israel will be allowed to use the U.S. ordnance in the event of a military emergency. Haaretz says that the report said that an agreement reached between Washington and Jerusalem last month will bring the value of the military gear to $800 million. Joining us to talk about the current situation in occupied Palestine, specifically from his standpoint in the hermetically sealed open-air prison of Gaza, is our good friend Haider Eid. Haider is an associate professor of culture studies at Al-Aqsa University in Gaza. He's also on the steering committee of PACB, One Democratic State Group, and the Gaza Freedom March. Haider, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you so much for having me on your show, Nora.
So let's begin by having you talk about the last 2 weeks in Gaza as Israeli military airstrikes and tank fire continue to kill Palestinians from the north to the south. We have yet to see the Obama administration even feign concern at these latest killings. I guess the U.S. White House is too busy making sure that this $800 million worth of military equipment will be accessible to Netanyahu. What's going on in Gaza right now? How are you looking
at this? Yeah, absolutely, Nora. I mean, what you've just said is absolutely correct. As I speak to you right now, I mean, I can hear shelling in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, the area of Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia, and Jabalia. And over the last, actually, 2 days, only yesterday, seven young men were killed. Three people were killed. Collecting scrap metal in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, and then there were also airstrikes in the middle camps, the Nusayrat and Deir al-Balah refugee camps, where also four young people were killed, and this comes amidst an escalation of airstrikes and shellings on the eastern part and even the southern part of the Gaza Strip, where last week there were about six airstrikes in the area of Rafah, targeting tunnels and killing four people, including a 12 years old boy. Now, of course, this comes amidst the deadly hermetic seas that you've just been talking about. I mean, more than 170 essential kinds of medicines are not allowed into Gaza. We do not have access. As I speak to you right now, for example, I don't have electricity. There has been a power failure for the last eight hours. There is shortages in cooking gas. As I said, medicine, water, different kinds of foods, including milk, chocolate, and pasta. And one really wonders sometimes. I mean, it is so bizarre that one wonders what kind of security threat does pasta or chocolate, for example, pose on the security of Israel. And add to that the fact that Egypt has decided to build the steel wall separating Gaza, on the border separating Gaza from Egypt. The Rafah crossing is rarely open for the Palestinians of Gaza to leave and go. Students, for example, to continue or rather further the education at Egyptian or European universities. So far, this deadly hermetic siege has killed more than 383 terminally ill people who have been denied actually permission to leave Gaza and be treated in Israeli or Egyptian or Jordanian hospitals. So the situation is getting worse and worse day by day.
Day. And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.